back to another edition of the Sunstone Podcast. I'm your host, John Larson, and today I want to talk about something that is, sort of near and dear to my thoughts and my worries and what I've been thinking about for the past 14 or 15 years. I want to kind of call what we're talking about tonight the ex-Mormon overcorrection. I want to first take a second and talk a little bit about mental illness and the problems we have in our culture and our language to express these things. When we talk about our physical health, we have lots and lots of different words to deal with how somebody is feeling. And we've even gone further to have more clinical definition. But if you take old language, old-fashioned terms, we can say things like, well, I'm a little bit under the weather. I have the sniffles. You could say, I've got a cold, or I've got a fever, or I've got the flu, or I've got pneumonia. I've got a persistent cough. I have, you know, we have different words, even taking a clinical setting out, that describe degrees. And there's no linguistic or cultural expectation that any illness is permanent. It happens, of course, all the time that people get chronic conditions. And even there, we have the word chronic that we can apply to it. But the most part of what everybody's dealing with is just routine. It's mundane. If a coworker called in for a day and said, you know, I'm feeling a little sick, nobody would think twice. Even if that coworker was out for a week and said, you know, I've had the flu, I've had a fever, we don't give that a lot of thought because it is a very common occurrence. It's expected that employers, if you're working a full-time kind of salary job, give employees time to take off, to deal with illness, to deal with sickness. The entire healthcare system from the base up, urgent cares and emergency rooms and clinical doctor visits are really just designed around diagnosing and treating these things that could be a life-ending malady or is most likely just something that's going to make you feel a little lousy for a couple days. The reason I'm harping on this point is we don't have the same language to deal with mental illness. And in reality, at least in my view, I'm not a mental health professional, the same paradigm actually plays out. That there are mental conditions that are chronic, and there are mental conditions that are incurable that will eventually lead to somebody's demise. But that doesn't describe most of what we deal with. We have a few words culturally. We might say, I'm feeling sad, or I have the blues, or you know, the individual's had a malaise, or an ennui. I mean, we can come up with terms, but as I was thinking about preparing for this, it struck me that almost all of these terms are synonyms of being sad. It's almost as if linguistically, historically, our ancestors acknowledge, at least the language we're using now, acknowledge sadness and really not much else. It makes sense because mental disorders are extremely hard to understand and extremely hard to treat. I think part of it is oftentimes we have an elixir or a pill or we can wrap somebody in a bandage and voila, they get better. With mental health, it's not the same. But there are a lot of things that happen to us day to day that give us mental bruises or mental scratches or cuts that give us little things that set us back but don't necessarily rise to the full level of trauma. And over the years, as I've encouraged people to talk to therapists and to deal with mental health issues, it's on this note that most of what you'll deal with from a mental health perspective in your life can be dealt with, can be treated. If time will go away, if you can make some lifestyle changes or talk to some people, get some guidance and counseling, most of these things can be dealt with just the same way as physical ailments can. But there's still this cultural baggage where we sort of act like it's not true. When somebody is struggling, we say they're depressed, not that this person is experiencing depression. If you think about that and compare it to the flu, we don't say somebody is flued. We say they have the flu. We linguistically separate the individual from the malady. We don't merge them together. But we do with mental illness, and I think that's a travesty and an injustice, especially to people who suffer a little bit from mental health. and need a little correction. I'm sort of laying this down as a foundation for the rest of what we're going to talk about, which is basically ex-Mormons kind of going too far. And I know what you're thinking about, probably, when I say ex-Mormons going too far. That's not what I'm thinking about. But I'll tell you what I'm thinking about here in a second. There seems to be kind of this immutable law of faith transition, which is the intensity and seriousness with which you approach Mormonism in this case, or any faith, will translate directly into the intensity and seriousness of your approach to leaving your faith, or deprogramming from your faith, or transitioning from your faith, however we want to play it out. And again, we've reached one of these things like I just laid out with mental illness. We really don't have the vocabulary to describe what happens mentally when somebody changes their worldview on religion, which is a very complex, interwoven set of beliefs and identities that speak to the core of who we are. So one of the criticisms has always been that ex-Mormons, at least the ex-Mormons you hear from, the ones who are active on the internet and on Reddit, and the ones who stand up in conference and vote no, and the ones who start podcasts and all these kind of things, that there's something wrong with them. And this is a common refrain among active people. They look and say, well, you know, the gospel is so beautiful and obviously true and obviously beneficial that for somebody to reject it, they must have mental problems. They must be either mentally ill, or the common explanation in fundamentalist religions like Mormonism is when you have mental illness, then it's demonic in nature. So we will frame out the people who reject their religion do so because they're quote unquote under the influence of Satan. And it's funny that we can just change the language to say exactly the same thing. You know, in the temple, I don't know what it changes so fast these days. I don't even know what's in there anymore. But in the temple, you know, the Lucifer used to say, if you don't live up to every covenant you make in these temples this day, then you will be in my power, which is another way of saying, if you don't do exactly what we're saying, you're demonically possessed and under a demonic influence. Well, the problem with that sort of language is then you no longer have to deal with anything anybody's saying. If somebody comes up with any kind of criticism, then you can discount it. Say, well, that's just obviously the influence of Satan. I don't have to listen. I don't have to process. I don't have to read the Quran to understand the Book of Mormon. I don't need to read the Bhagavad Gita to understand the context of the Doctrine and Covenants. This one's true. That one's false. This one's from God. That one's from the devil. So I don't have to deal with it. But this leads us to the problem that ex-Mormons face internally and externally. Is that framework, just like depression, doesn't have the kind of nuance that really people need to understand what happens to them psychologically. And I'm not just talking about that external. Matter of fact, more I'm talking tonight about what happens internally. So the Mormon universe is really divided up into these three main categories. You have active Mormons, and a lot of those people drift in and out of activity. They might fall inactive for a month or a year or 2 years, then they go back, and then they come out, and they go out, they go back. And usually that has to do more with the reasons that they struggle with the church are more about practice than doctrine. And both of those things are equally valid. One doesn't have precedence over the other. So you have your active Mormons, and then you have your Jack Mormons. These are people who, you know, grew up in the church, or their families in the church. They have a modest understanding of Mormon theology. They may or may not practice. In fact, most of them don't practice the same way the active Mormons. You know, active Mormons might be encouraged to attend the temple every week, where Jack Mormons might just attend the temple at their wedding and the wedding of their children, and that's the only time that they go. Well, I think being a Jack Mormon is sort of a function of how seriously you take the doctrine and belief. And again, this is not a value statement. Somebody who engages the church and doesn't take the doctrine very seriously is probably much more healthy in terms of a psychological and mental health approach than somebody who takes the dogma and doctrine very seriously. either because they're Orthodox or they're a reversal of Orthodox. They're an Orthodox ex-Mormon. Those states of being, in my unprofessional view, seem to lead people to have more psychological trauma in the transition. And I'm talking in part from my own experience. I took Mormonism very seriously, studied it very, very hard. I took them at their word. You know, if they told me that we couldn't get baptisms unless we were totally obedient on the mission, then I tried to be totally obedient. I didn't just discount. And I know I've visited with enough people over the years now to know that my framework wasn't necessarily the most common one. That I think most people were much more nuanced in their engagement and belief and better able to just shuffle off. Those people who don't necessarily take the beliefs and practices that seriously, in my opinion, don't struggle as much when they come to an actual faith crisis. Because the crisis point isn't, that inflection point isn't as acute for them. They might be upset about, I don't know, the church's handling of Prop 8 or something they said over the pulpit about LGBT issues or something that's current, and they might walk out of the church and say, you know what, I don't want to hear this stuff. I find this stuff offensive or whatever. But they don't necessarily go in and process and say, well, in what way did Joseph Smith translate the Book of Mormon and that sort of stuff? So my point that I'm driving to is that the intensity with which one attacks religion is the intensity with one attacks religion, or what by attack I mean embraces it, studies it, jumps in, reads. So the people who struggle the most, the iconic ex-Mormon, the egg-headed ex-Mormon who becomes a walking windbag know-it-all about every little nuance in church history, people like me, I'm not pointing fingers elsewhere. That is a direct function of how we approached Mormonism when we were there. And in that sense, at that first inflection point, when one abandons their traditional Orthodox faith and becomes an X, a reversal, the same modes, methods, psychology, predilections, however you want to say, that individual has will be 100% present at that point of inflection. Now, it's my experience that intensity remains for a transitional period of time. And I think for most ex-Mormons, it's somewhere between 6 months and what's the rule I've given for? A year for every decade? Something like that. So if you've been in the church three decades and you took it very seriously for those 3 decades, you studied it, it's probably going to take you about 3 years to mentally adjust. Now, not everybody does adjust. So there are many Orthodox Mormons who leave the church and never become quote-unquote ex-Mormons. These people experience a transition or a faith transition, a conversion, we might say. And if you go to any church in Utah, I don't pick your denomination, I would dare say about a third of that congregation are ex-Mormons. Even though those folks don't actually tend to identify with the ex-Mormon movement, especially if they went from Mormonism to another fundamentalist religion. So, for example, if you were to go and have dinner with the Scientologists or the Jehovah's Witnesses, or the Southern Baptist evangelicals, you'll find that there are quite a few ex-Mormons amongst them, but they never took like the Sunstone let's deconstruct God route. Okay, so if we look at what is religion, I want to dig into why this transition, why ex-Mormons, especially in the beginning, are just Mormons. What is religion? Well, it's fundamentally not logic, science, or reason. Because if it was logic, science, or reason, it would just be part of logic, science, or reason. So one could have a religion in which they say, I believe everything that the current body of academics in the field of physics believes. And you could define a religion that way, but it wouldn't have much punch. It wouldn't mean much of anything. You're just restating and saying, well, science is my religion. And then you'd run into problems with actual religious practice, which we'll get to here in a few minutes. But you could do that, but it really doesn't fit our definition of religion. What religion is it's based on a few non-scientific, non-logical, or non-reasonable things. All religions are this way. So when I say something is unreasonable, it means it doesn't follow a pattern of reason. It might be full of internal contradictions. It might have two different storylines that can't be resolved. It might have doctrines that in this instance, the leader said do this. And in a very similar instance, the leader said do something else. So they'll have fundamental contradictions. More often than not, especially when a church is first born, it will have a spin on understanding or scientific understanding of the day. In fact, you can kind of pinpoint when religions were born because they tend to be absolutely scientific for the date they were born. So Joseph Smith's Pearl of Great Price, if you read it, it's not that far out from a scientific perspective of the 1830s and 1840s. But as science progressed and grew, then some of the models, the solar celestial models that Joseph Smith was proposing and went into great detail about in the Doctrine and Covenants, were plausibly scientific in the mid 19th century, and they're not at all now. They're just something else. They're just myth, but a myth that doesn't disappear in the order of time. So when we have a religion that of necessity, of definition, has to have some things that can't be resolved academically, that then you have a couple of different measures to measure somebody's commitment to the church, to the religion, or to the church. And I've identified basically three. One is orthodoxy. The orthodoxy is how much in your life you want to conform to the life as prescribed in the scriptures or by the church leaders or by the religious practice. So religions in the United States today are full of many, many unorthodox people. And there's a degree of orthodoxy. There's quite a few Muslims and Jews, for example, who will eat pork. They may, and then that is on a whole different spectrum. If it's fed to them, but they don't seek it, they wouldn't ever eat it on a high holy day or part of a festival. And then there's those who would never touch it, and they will go to great lengths. Well, every religion of necessity has these degrees of orthodoxy. Even old religions that seem to be fairly tolerant, like if we take Hinduism, there are sects inside Hinduism that are very orthodox and very very willing to use violence or other means to enforce that orthodoxy. So orthodoxy is the first one, which is kind of a measure of conformance. The second one is commitment. And this isn't just orthodoxy. This is how much you're willing to just keep doing the things. Do you pay what you're supposed to pay? Do you go to temple every week? Do you go to church every week? How much do you get involved in your life? And the third one is zeal, which to me is kind of like, how much do you really get off on doing the first two? So we have all met individuals who are extremely orthodox, extremely committed, and extremely zealous. I have met some people who are very orthodox, but their commitment and zeal are practically zero. They very, very much believe Mormonism and believe that you should do X, Y, and Z, but they just don't do it. So you kind of have to have all those factors. So if you took and could give everybody who goes through a faith crisis like a score, you know, on a 1 to 10, of how orthodox they are, how committed they are, how much zeal they have, what you'd find is the minute they switch, especially if it's a conversionary process that flips really fast. Not everybody does that. There's some people who, as they start having problems with their orthodoxy, their commitment and their zeal will start to wane. And I think for some of these people, they reach a zero point. At that point, they probably don't become ex-Mormons per se. They probably just kind of walk away. Again, others will take their zeal and commitment for Mormonism, and they'll transfer it to the Southern Baptist Convention. For others, they will just reduce their orthodoxy until they can find a level where they can justify in their own mind that even though there's all these things being said in church that they don't agree with, they're very unorthodox, they're going to still be able to engage. So the ex-Mormon overcorrection really comes from people who are high on these marks, orthodox, commitment, and zeal. And as many have pointed out statistically, although it feels like most ex-Mormons fit into this high orthodox, high commitment, high zeal category, the fact is most of them don't. And that's why you really don't hear from most of them.
Can we talk more?
Hi, I'm Lindsay Anson Park, Executive Director of the Sunstone Education Foundation. I want to invite you to our weekly Sunstone Firesides. Do you remember those? Firesides that they used to have dating all the way back to the 1930s, when the LDS Church would hold monthly meetings to discuss really important gospel topics. Those meetings became known endearingly as Firesides. In January of 2019, Sunstone launched a new podcast that incorporates a nod to these Firesides. Featuring a weekly evening podcast, it will display a range of hosts, all women, as they chat with diverse guests from across the Mormon spectrum. The hosts are all female-identifying that represent a broad perspective in Mormonism. These podcasts will be released every Thursday evening, so you can have that fireside feel brought right into your living room. So grab a cup of cocoa or coffee, since at Sunstone there is more than one way to Mormon. Snuggle up under a blanket and listen to incredible interviews by and from incredible people. You can support women and their work in Mormon studies, which is desperately needed, by donating at sunstone.org or becoming a monthly subscriber. Go to sunstone.org and click on the podcast tab for more info. We hope you enjoy it as much as we do.
So the problem is, once you have a set of belief that you might have your own pattern of orthodoxy, commitment, and zeal, you've got a reframing problem the moment that you reject the paradigm. And we could talk a lot about conversion and deconversion processes, but for almost everybody, there is a moment, there is this switch moment, a moment when they recognize that their paradigm might be wrong and that they need to reevaluate. For some, it is a slow, slow burn. That's the way it was for me. It took me years and years and years of study and thinking and discussing with people before I could process to the point and like, yeah, I get it. I no longer believe the church. For others, the process happens almost instantaneously. There'll be some, it's almost like a Zen koan. There'll be some element that gives them that instant karma, and they instantly do a paradigm shift. They instantly say, black is white and white is black. And, you know, when you look around the world today, you know, you look at the insane battles the conservatives and liberals are having today in the United States, you can see how entrenched and how devoted on both sides, on all sides, there's more than two, people get. They get invested in these ideas. And once those ideas get reversed, you can see this happening with never Trumpers. Most people just kind of go away into that good night. But there's some who it lights up their zeal and they want to fight against what they see as a betrayal. So each ex-Mormon has to deal with their own orthodox commitment and zeal and other spiritual experiences they encountered. And you have to reframe those. So the first step of deconversion is really having that, whatever education you need to prime the pump. And some people that's 10 years. Then there's that conversion experience where you go through a parallax, where something looks one way one minute, and then the next minute it gets reversed and you can see it from a different point of view. Then what you have to do is the third phase, which is very difficult and is mentally taxing. It will give you the mental sniffles. And there's a problem because the narrative that the people around ex-Mormons impose on ex-Mormons is that they will sin and they will have problems in their life and they will struggle. Well, the very act of switching out that commitment and zeal and orthodoxy causes people to violate orthodoxy, i.e. sin. It causes people to have internal crisis, i.e. suffering. And oftentimes, there are whole aspects of their life that are built around their participation in the church. So there will be external trauma. Marriages can end. Children can disown parents. Parents can disown children. People can be laid off from jobs. People can lose their social connections. They can lose their professional relationships. All of these things combine to actually put individuals into a situation where not only do they have to process their own previous take on religion, but they're doing so in a hostile environment. And I think one of the unfortunate things that I see in dealing with the ex-Mormon community is how committed ex-Mormons are to convincing themselves and the rest of the world that their lives are better. I want to give everybody permission to say your life will not be better when you convert out of a religion, especially if you have a high degree of orthodoxy or a high degree of commitment, because the structure and framework of your life has been injured seriously, and that will cause emotional and mental trauma. It will cause bruising and cutting and the mental flu that will get better over time, especially if you get it treated. But, you know, most illnesses, even if you don't go to the doctor, they'll get better over time. Because of that, ex-Mormons tend to take this view that they have this orthodoxy, and they're still applying it to the rest of the world because it's not really clear when you do a major paradigm shift, like from Mormonism to ex-Mormonism, what in your pile of orthodoxy, what in your pile of commitments that you had before were actually very good. Which things were you being involved with the church that were beneficial to your family and to your community and to yourself? They're so intertwined and tangled up with the church's truth claims and insistence on authority and submission to authority that it leaves people in a mental dither as they try to determine and vet all of their beliefs. Ones they don't even fully understand. I think this many years later for me, every great once in a while, I'll still come up with something that I need to interrogate that might be from my Mormon upbringing. More likely they're from my American upbringing or my status of whiteness or the privilege or even the persecution or the problems I've had in my life that still impact me. And that's why I think mental health needs to be an ongoing element of addressing for each of us. Okay, I've kind of done this enormous buildup to kind of the money shot here. So let's look at the history of humankind, especially when it comes to religion. Anthropologists do this all the time, and one way to frame out the study of anthropology is trying to determine what things are human universals. Once you find something is universal, by that I mean that it shows up in every single culture, then you have a second problem. You have to determine if it's genetic or if it is just something that all cultures come to. Most likely, from a statistical perspective, if you find something that's universal, it's going to be more likely than not a part of our DNA and a part of what makes us human. And some of those things are manifest in culture. Culture is really kind of the driving force that separated the human beings from other species. There are other species that have culture-like elements. For example, organisms that function in a collective or a social hierarchy. Let's think like naked mole rats, bees, ants. There appears to be a sort of meta-consciousness that arises higher, and they have ways of expressing these things, normally through their innate genetics. Like a bee doesn't have to get taught that if it wiggles its rear end five times and spins to the left and spins to the right, that means, you know, you go over this way and you go that way. But that's what it does for bees. They do a little dance, and the other bees know exactly where they're supposed to go. But that where they're supposed to go is the cultural element. So the evolution of the little bee dance put in place of the collective of bees a way for them to communicate one with the other. Well, let's say one of these bees became self-aware, became conscious, like you and me. And that bee was greedy, like human beings are. We're all really greedy. So that bee figures out that he can dance a certain way, and he can send the rest of the the tribe or the colony off to go do his bidding to get the pollen or get the whatever it is that he wants. To me, that's kind of a tortured metaphor for what's happened with human beings over the past 50 or 100,000 years or whatever, is we have these elements that united us together as a culture. We, as naked, kind of defenseless animals, we're not the top-of-the-line predators. We're not tigers. We can't really survive on our own. We have to survive as a group. And so groups, you know, just like cows and gazelles, know to herd up. They know to stampede in certain ways. They have a collective knowledge of how to behave themselves as a group. And we have those same things. And those things manifest in many, many ways. In a lot of ways, our consciousness, what we understand and how we can transmit ideas to one another, keeps getting in the way of understanding what it means to be human and what things really speak to us. For example, almost every religion has some form of an altered state of consciousness. Some of them have heavy altered states of consciousness. Some of them have lightweight altered states of consciousness. Some of them have collective altered states of consciousness. Sometimes it's only permitted for the shaman or for an acolyte or somebody who's on a vision quest. But if we look down the list, we see these things that are common. We see alcohol and wine, hallucinogenics like peyote, dancing or spinning around like a whirling dervish. We see ecstasy dancing like in modern voodoo and other traditions where people will just dance and dance and dance, just the same way people do it at raves. We see drumming, and especially drumming as it relates to the individual's heartbeat, where you use it to kind of control and collectively push people to a higher state of engagement. Light and lighting. Smoke and shadows, light creeping into caves, light creeping into old buildings, today using modern strobes and flashing lights. We singing and chanting, sitting for long periods of time, repetition of words, saying the same thing over and over and over again, using scent. Scent is very, very common in all sorts of religious rites. Using light, and the crackling of fire or fire noise, and staring into candles, staring into flames, staring into mirrors and glasses. And if you just take this list, that's probably not a full list, but these are all ways that human beings achieve altered states of consciousness. And what you'll see is you'll see them show up all over the place in little areas. Like when you get sealed in the celestial room in a Mormon temple, they always hang two mirrors on either side of the room so you can look in and you can mirror gaze into this. They always use it as a metaphor for eternity, but it produces a really trippy sort of mildly psychedelic experience to stare into a mirror that is reflecting to a mirror as it kind of reflects itself on and on. And those experiences might be intense in such a way that produce revelation or poetry seersmanship, all sorts of things that through culture we rely on these people as oracles to tell us a deeper truth that we just can't get to on our own. What I think is also fascinating about these things is if you pick any one religion, you can find usually multiple ways that they produce altered states of consciousness, but they will oftentimes ban the others. So, like, for example, even though wine was a big part of sacrament service in the 19th century Mormonism, especially in Nauvoo and Kirtland period, it is absolutely forbidden now for Mormonism. Music is used, but they do kind of dirge music, kind of slow, rhythmic, repetitive music. That's a common way around the world to create altered states of consciousness. Drums are absolutely taboo in Mormonism, but in world religions everywhere, there's drumming is an absolute part. So you see where I'm getting at is there are these elements that you cannot ascribe to a religion. I think you'd be hard pressed to say evangelicalism created having the drum kit there on stage or having guitars on stage. It didn't create that. Those things are in our culture. And if you take a guitar, you can trace it back and 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 back to the dawn of history before we know anything about what humans were doing, what they were doing, just by a few random fossils and leavings around. But we see that these elements were common. This comes to the overcorrection.
You look pretty righteous, so I'm not sure you're going to understand this simile, but most podcasts are like beer. You have to drink a lot to get that buzz. The Sunstone Magazine podcast, on the other hand, is like whiskey. Small glass, big buzz. That's because our podcast isn't about interviews, conversation, or witty banter. Rather, it presents audible quality recordings of Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry. Do you want to hear what the best LDS minds have to say when they say it perfectly? Then this podcast is for you. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. And then join us for a weekly shot of the best of Mormon thought and experience. And yes, you'll be able to drive home safely afterward and get a temper recommend if you want.
The ex-Mormon overcorrection that I keep teasing to and talking about all the psychology is that when one has an orthodoxy, one believes the church to be true, quote unquote, and then one decides the church is not true. Both of those constructions, deciding the church is true or deciding the church is not true, are absolutely a Mormon line of thinking. It is not a phrase that would make much sense to people who are not familiar with a Mormon paradigm of thinking. They just simply wouldn't understand what you mean by saying the church is true. And of course, there's been several times in the past where I've recorded about why it doesn't make any sense, how it's so easy to break down, and it doesn't follow any sort of logical symmetry to say this whole collection of beliefs, practices, people, history is true or false. But ex-Mormons, when they leave the church at that inflection point, have that exact same paradigm in their head. So they will then start talking about the church not being true. But the statement the church is not true is equally as ridiculous and paradoxical as the statement that the church is true. Because you can take any sort of a prototypical Mormon guy, let's call him Bob. And Bob always puts his time in at the Ward Farm. Do they still have those? He goes to the Ward Cannery. Do they still have those? He might participate with the Young Men's and Young Women's program. He always signs up and does everything charitable. He lives a very Christ-like existence inside of Mormonism. Not everybody has to do that. So if you go to Bob and say, Bob, the church isn't true. Joseph Smith lied about this, that, and the other. The brethren have been deceiving you on this. They've got all this money, blah, blah, blah. Bob's going to say, I don't know what you're talking about. That's not Mormonism to me. Mormonism to me is helping other people. Mormonism to me is going to church every Sunday and being there with my brothers and sisters. Mormonism is giving me hope in my family. Mormonism is giving me a bulwark against a society that is fickle and constantly changing. Mormonism to me is connecting to my neighbors. All of this, for Bob, can be absolutely true. But there might be another guy who lives one ward over, Steve, who's Bishop was a jerk to him, whose home teachers let him know that because his child is gay, he's not going to be loved or whatever. Both of those experiences can be true and happen in the church. And they're both true from a particular point of view. If Bob is arguing that his church is true, he's right in the sense that singing hymns will produce an altered state of consciousness that can make one feel closer with the cosmos. That has been pretty well scientifically framed. But ex-Mormons can go out and say, no, the church isn't true, so when you're singing those terrible hymns and when you're playing the terrible organ music, you're not doing it right. Well, that accusation of not doing it right is just a fallacy that's actually coming out of the church itself. It's applying all this paradigm to the rest of the world. Ex-Mormons, for example, have a tendency to go engage the rest of the world and look for truth, quote unquote. I'm not against truth. I think truth is a valid pursuit. But the framework that they take of the Mormon paradigm of truth, I think, is not a good paradigm of truth, and it's not one that can be useful for reasons I just stated a few minutes ago. So if religion is a complex model to deal with reality, what it does is it tells us what to pay attention to and what to ignore. Now, I might look and see that Bob pays his fast offering because he really wants to help people who are in need, but Bob doesn't bother going to the temple every week, like the stake president says. Bob goes once every year or so, you know, just when he wants to support other people. Now, an Orthodox person might look at them and say, oh, Bob, you're doing it wrong. And an ex-Mormon might create a framework saying, if you're going to be an active Mormon, you have to go to the temple every month, or whatever they say. Both of those paradigms are completely wrong. But we're not just talking about what people do to blame completely wrong. I mean, they're not completely wrong. They can be harmful in terms that they might lead us to come to other false or harmful conclusions. Okay, so the ex-Mormons, what they tend to do, and again, yours truly is guilty of every sin I'm laying at anybody else's feet, is that they, first of all, tend to look at Mormonism, the rest of the world, through that Mormon fisheye. And luckily, it does tend to get better over time, especially if they engage and try to learn and see and grow and understand the scientific principles and understand the world, the way it works. Try to be empathetic of other people's religious view. Try to make friends with a Hindu and have them explain to you what they believe, not you explaining to the Hindu what they believe. When those sort of things happen, then real progress can move forward. But I think the real tragedy and the real problem with the overcorrection is we throw out much of what I would call spirituality. Now, I am still agnostic. I don't really believe in anything supernatural per se, but those words are so squishy. Those words are so hard to pin down. Let me give you an example. Our modern brains, our modern the cranial capacity. If we can find really old skulls, if I remember right. There are skulls that are basically look modern that are 200,000 years old, 200,000 years. But when we look at the fossil remains to look at the bones and structure that's required for vocal cords, they evolved and developed the ability that we have now to speak at a much later date. The only obvious conclusion is that there was a period of time, forever how long, that we're basically as smart as we are now, but we couldn't really talk to each other. We might have talked in grunts and the way a pack of dogs can talk to each other, which, by the way, is brilliant and amazing, and we don't really understand it. But we most likely weren't able to communicate anywhere like we do now. That means there were other senses and other elements, and there still are, that are playing out in our psyche that help us understand people. You know how sometimes you get a weird feeling around somebody, or you kind of have an intuition for what's really going on? Nobody really said it, but you're right. Oftentimes, those instincts and those sort of things are correct, especially for people who are very careful in their thinking and tend to shut out the noise. There are a lot of people who are very intuitive and can oftentimes in their life come to conclusions that seem to defy a straightforward logical explanation. Now, I don't posit that that's because there are spirits whispering in some people's ears. I posit that human psyche and human communication is more complicated than we want to admit. And there's ways that we talk to each other and communicate with each other that go beyond being verbal. So that's where I can see a wonder and an awe and a mystery in life without necessarily having to theorize that there's these creatures out there living in space. So I think that as Mormons take that as ex-Mormons take that Mormon view, what they tend to do is they tend to jettison everything that the religion is doing. And if you ignore what people in authority, we focus way too much on authority when we're talking about the value that religion has for people. If we stop talking about what stake presidents and bishops are doing, if we stop talking about what they're doing in Salt Lake City, and we look at the core, the heart of what most Mormons are doing, what we see is a lot of goodness, a lot of structure, people who help one another, people who take you a meal when you're sick, people who will come, and if they notice you haven't had time to mow your lawn, will mow your lawn. These are the fruits, or some of the fruits, of Mormonism. And these are some of the fruits of basically every religion and every worldview. And the benefit of religion is that it does tend to use, in my view, these old, old cultural ways that human beings had to connect with each other and to care for each other and to develop bonds and develop a tribe and develop a people and develop a sense of community that would help them take care of children that maybe weren't their own or interact kindly with people, even if those people didn't give them food or sex or whatever else they were seeking. These structures and these elements allow for us to create a latticework of humanity. And I'm afraid that in the secular movement of which Mormonism is a part, we've become very zealous, very orthodox and committed and zealous, the same aspects I've kind of framed out as negative traits in a religion, of dismantling religion. And the casualty has been these elements that are core to who we are. And the tragedy I see now when I go and interact with ex-Mormons is their defiance around submitting themselves to the kind of ritual and the kind of practice and the kind of devotion that bring about hugely positive psychological outcomes in our own lives and in our own communities. So to me, this is all wreckage from Mormonism, which is a view that has many great things, especially at the root level, but has become kind of perverted in a sense that we're using what should be something about love and peace and joy to hurt other people and to take from them and to use up the good things. I recorded a podcast several years ago. It's a phrase I see get used quite a bit, so I'm always tickled when I see it, that the church does, it takes everything that you have, a value, and then it sells it back to you at a price. And the Mormon church and other churches do this flat out. They will say, how many times in sacrament have you heard somebody get up and say, you know what, if it wasn't for the church today, I would be out raping people and I'd be dead in a ditch somewhere. That person may be true. They may be right, but I doubt it for most of us. I doubt that most Mormons are not raping people because the church tells them not to. And again, I've seen many thousands of people leave the church, and those that go out and start raping and pillaging are extremely rare. So what's the takeaway here? I've talked a lot about psychology. I've talked a lot about the problems of orthodoxy. I think there's a couple. One, we need to recognize that these things are difficult. They are very difficult to deal with any changing faith. And if you listen to the church these last few years, the last 5 or 6 years, things are changing quickly. I'm very empathetic of my believing Orthodox brothers and sisters, because it must be a very difficult place to be right now, not knowing from conference session to conference session, what is going to change? Where do I house my faith? How do I build my foundation upon this rock if this rock keeps moving? I don't mean that as a criticism. I mean, it's very psychologically difficult. And then my ex-Mormon brothers and sisters, they have the mental sniffles that it's like being bruised. It's like being beat up. And we need to help take care of each other. And it's okay to admit that none of this is okay. That none of this is easy, that this is all hard from everybody's perspective, and there's no good answers. There's no easy right way to do it, and we have to keep working it out. Second thing, we need to be very careful about interrogating our own beliefs and slowly over time sort of vet them out. And then sort of the last thing is recognizing, my dear ex-Mormons, that I see so many of you where I once was, which is an Orthodox believing Mormon who became disillusioned, who studied their way out of the church, and then found new zeal in demonstrating and proving that the church wasn't true, and found identity in it. But now that I've seen so many people who 10 years after that, 15 years after that, they find that doesn't give them as much meaning and joy. And I would say, look back to our roots. There is so much in the church that is good for us. And it's good for us in ways that we don't fully understand. I don't pray. I don't believe in any particular incarnation of a God. But prayer works for so many people. For so many people, prayer helps them understand their own thoughts, understand their own feelings, take a breath. It helps them categorize things. It helps them slow down. And what I wish is that more ex-Mormons would keep praying, but maybe just change who they pray to and who they pray about. Again, prayer does not work for me, and I don't think there's anything in the universe that would say prayer is an act of a mortal communicating with an immortal. But I do think prayer, for example, is an act of communicating with yourself. I think sitting down and having ward dinner with whatever ward that you can muster up brings value. I think contemplating the mystery and awe and wonder of our being and dealing with the humanity that exists in our death and the pain that we have to deal with there. So the ex-Mormon overcorrection, I believe, is in the name of truth and in the name of atheism, oftentimes, of discarding what really it means to be human. What does that look like? I don't know. I'm not about to try to start a religion. I am enjoying the journey with me and my friends and others as we try to figure out what ways to live and what we should bring back. What things were there for a long time for a reason? Which seasons did we celebrate? What foods did we eat? What things did we do? What did we sing that oftentimes predate Christianity or prehistory? What does it mean to be human? How do we connect with others? How do we connect with the world around us? And let's not discard all of Mormonism on that front. I think our challenge before us all today, in the age that we live in here in 2020, is we have to quit trying to play for the end game. Mormons need to quit trying to build for the post-apocalyptic world, and ex-Mormons need to quit trying to build for the world in which there's no longer Mormons here. Jesus ain't coming anytime soon, and the Mormon church ain't going anywhere. The all of the political offices are not going to be elected as Republicans, and they're all not going to be elected as Democrats. So we have to learn to live with ourselves. And I think living with ourselves means getting in touch with your own sense of wonder and awe and spirituality. Well, that's a lot to take in. If you stayed with me through it, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Last time I recorded, I gave out my wrong email address. I am so sorry. My email at Sunstone is johnlarson@sunstone.org. My personal address that you can contact me is john@johnlarson.org. Make sure to spell it with an E and not an O. I'd love to hear your thoughts and hear from you. Anyway, we're coming up on the deadline for, I think, March 1st is for submitting papers for Sunstone. We need to hear from you, different perspectives. If you're not academic, if you don't have big grand ideas, it doesn't matter. Your journey, your experience, your thoughts are will touch somebody there. And I invite everyone, if they can, come out to the Lollapalooza of Mormonism Sunstone Conference, which usually happens like the last week of July, first week in August. When I get dates in front of me, I'll give that to you. Thanks for all of your kind words and for your friendship. And until next time.